Okay, before we begin, does anyone have any questions about the course or anything? Let me pick up where I left off last time. Last time we talked about the post-Versailles period, the period going from the negotiation of the treaty settlement in Paris, the big treaty with Germany, was the Treaty of Versailles of 1919, from that to the Ruhr Crisis of 1923. What's the point of that whole analysis? Why does it matter? Well, we're interested in a theoretical problem, a conceptual problem. How do you understand what makes for war? And kind of connected with that, this whole issue of what makes for good foreign policy? And we get at those issues not directly by approaching them on a purely abstract level, but by trying to translate them into stories, into interpretations of what was going on in actual international politics. And the whole normative issue of how foreign policy should be conducted. You know, what are the general guidelines for the conduct of foreign policy, if any? We try and get at those issues by examining them in specific historical contexts. What should have been done after the First World War? What should policy have been in this particular context? You know, and you saw, for example, in that Cannon article, you know, some scholars have very strong views about what should have been done, what was wrong with the way things were done, right? And we approach those issues not in some general abstract level, but by looking at what scholars, what theorists have had to say about that whole complex of questions. And there are these two great schools that dominate the debate here. On both sets of issues, on a set of issues of how does international politics work, and the issue of how should foreign policy be conducted. Right? There's the liberal school and the realist school. The realist school kind of derives its power from the fact that it makes claims that are largely counterintuitive, given all these notions that you know you just absorb growing up in a country like the United States. The natural way of thinking about policy is, well, what makes for war? You have to understand it in moral terms. War is the product of aggression. You have peace-loving countries, and then you have these aggressors, and the aggressors cause war. So you want to understand the cause of war, you have to kind of figure out who the aggressor was. Again, a moral interpretation. And similarly with regard to the normative issue about how foreign policy should be conducted, well, it should be conducted according to moral principles. You know, you should have a sense for what's right and frame your policy accordingly. You want to achieve your goals. And what are your views about how are your views about what's right shaped? Well, they're shaped by the values you absorb from your own culture. In the case of the United States, well, democracy is good, freedom is good, self-determination is good, human rights good, rule of law is good. Those are the basic principles that should lie at the heart of American foreign policy, for example. Right? Shouldn't think in terms of balance of power. You know, all these policies that said, you know, you should frame your policy in accordance with your own interests. Well, you didn't want to go. You don't want to go that route. That's kind of selfish. You look at the history of the pre-World War I period, when countries pursued those kinds of policies, balance of power policies, power politics based on interest, based on the use of force, and so on. That was a big part of the problem. You know, we want to get away from that, right? That's the kind of liberal view of things, right? And in reaction to that, you have this realist school, okay? The realist school basically argues that what's of fundamental importance is power. You know, countries may talk in terms of their ideals, but when push comes to shove, countries act in accordance with their self-interest. Maybe this is not obvious from the sort of discourse, from the sort of rhetoric political leaders use, but when they're by themselves in private, they know what they have to do to promote the interests of their country. You know, one sort of language they'll use in public, a very different language they'll use in private. In private, the policies they pursue are policies based on their own national interests. Balance of power considerations shape the policies of great nations, all right? And then, somewhat inconsistently with that, realists also argue that's the kind of policy a country should pursue because they often don't pursue those sorts of policies. And as I say, that contrasts with their way of interpreting things. And when they don't pursue those sorts of policies, they screw things up. All right? How do you get at that issue? Again, not on a purely conceptual level, but by looking at the problem in specific historical context. Right? Number one case in point is the whole story of the failure of the peace after the First World War. You know? Who's responsible? Well, liberals say, oh, it was because you had Woodrow Wilson with his visionary peace program, a peace program based on moral considerations, on the right of self-determination, so, you know, on the rule of law, League of Nations, international organization, very important from this point of view. And Wilson was defeated. You know, these European allies, they might be democracies in terms of their own internal politics, but they were also great imperial powers. Britain had this huge empire. France had this huge empire. They still thought in power political terms. They were unable to fully grasp the power of the Wilsonian vision, and they sabotaged Wilson at power at Paris. They bamboozled Wilson. They got Wilson to kind of go along with what they wanted and betray his own ideals. All right? They were the blame. They were the villains. Again, you see all the moral connotations here. Is that, and we want to ask, is that view in fact correct? And so we looked at the Paris Peace Conference in some detail. We looked at the Wilsonian program in some detail. Okay? What do you find? Well, that standard view of Wilson as the champion of a peace of reconciliation, someone who wanted to establish a just and durable peace, not quite true. Wilson wanted a punitive peace. He viewed war as a crime. You know, again, that's central to the liberal view of war as the result of aggression. Criminals had to be punished. Okay? You look to the past. If your basic notion is justice, justice means, among other things, the punishment of the aggressors. You fashion a peace settlement that's oblivious to powerful political considerations. For example, you resurrect this Polish state, pure application of the principle of self-determination, without regard to the powerful political consequences of it. And yet it was clear that the establishment of Poland weakened the forces that were that could constrain Germany, right? Why? Because it shielded Germany from the possibility of Russian pressure in the future. And conversely, it also shielded Russia from the possibility of a German invasion. It empowered those two countries at the expense of the victor powers to a certain extent, right? But this whole sense of the principle of self-determination runs counter to the goal of creating stable international order because it ignores power political considerations of that sort. Well, that's a fundamental point. Okay? So you look at these conceptual issues in that particular historical context, in the context of peacemaking after the war. All right, so then we did that, and then we saw that there was this basic problem here. You know, on the one hand, you have this peace that's fashioned that's bound to provoke Germany, because it deprives Germany of equality of rights. Germany is kept down, or, you know, by this whole set of constraints, the essence of the Versailles system, the disarmament provisions, the provisions about the demilitarization of the Rhineland and the occupation of the Rhineland by foreign powers for a certain period of time. Okay. All these provisions in the Treaty of Versailles keep Germany down, and the basis for that, what gives those features their legitimacy, is the notion that Germany deserves to be punished because Germany had caused the war. So you're provoking Germany in two ways, both in power political terms and moral terms. Power political terms, every great nation wants to be able to do what it has to control its own destiny, to provide for its own security. You know, a great nation like Germany does not want to be a satellite of France. So the Germans have a basic interest in recovering their power, if only because in the long run, you know, Russian power is bound to re-emerge as the Russians get their act together. And Germany had to be prepared to defend herself. Or, you know, so you have those kinds of power political considerations. Germany cannot accept being defenseless, essentially, unless she's utterly compelled to do so. And then Germany finds it very hard to accept the verdict that Germany is a criminal nation, especially since, you know, as more and more evidence became available, and it was very important for the Germans to kind of, you know, publish documents from the pre-war period, although they published them somewhat selectively. But as historians began to work on this, and as the passions of the war faded, a more balanced view of what had caused the war took shape, and it was quite clear that Germany was not solely responsible, that this war was not a war of German aggression, pure and simple, and that the story was a whole lot more complex than that. Right? So you have Germany provoked in these two ways, on the one hand, and whether German resistance would be a viable policy would depend on the overall political conjuncture and what the overall balance of forces was. And it was clear that France was a much weaker country than Germany in the long run, and that France was therefore dependent ultimately on Britain and America coming to her aid if push came to shove in the long run. And so Britain and America could exercise a certain influence in restraining France from enforcing the treaty. Britain and America could restrain France from enforcing the treaty, and British and American policy shifted. Why? Because it soon became clear that this whole notion that Wilson had, that, well, it's obvious that we are right, and our sense for things embodies the truth, and that Germany really had caused the war, and we are totally within our rights in imposing this sort of punitive settlement, and the Germans will in their hearts know that they were right and go along with it. You know, it rapidly became clear that that was an illusion, and that as Germany began to resist and try and chip away at the Versailles system, the whole question arose of whether the Versailles system would be enforced, whether the French would be allowed to use force against Germany. And now the liberal view was, oh no, you can't use force. Force can't be used as a normal element in international political life. It can only be used when the moral issues were absolutely clear cut. So you shouldn't use force. The use of force is militaristic, and militarism, you know, is one of the great taproots of international instability, so you can't do that. So France is held back. The Germans sense that France is held back. There's no pressure on Germany from the east, because Russia is in a shambles and pushed back behind this wall of anti-communist East European states. You know, there's very little holding Germany down except for the possibility that France will, in desperation, use force against Germany. So the Germans have a lot of room for maneuver here, and this encourages German resistance, right? So that's the story. What is German resistance to the Versailles system focus on? The reparation issue. Why? Because the reparations are the easiest target. They're technically most difficult to enforce. It's easiest for people in the West to sympathize with Germany's claim that she can't pay the reparations. And so the struggle over the treaty focuses on the reparation issue. Germany resists. The French try and reach an accommodation with Germany. That's the story of 1920, culminating in the Seydoux Plan. I talked about this stuff last time. A lot of people in Germany want to accept the outstretched hand, as one of them put it. But ultimately, they are defeated. And push comes to shove. And finally, January 1923, the French occupy the Ruhr, the industrial heartland of Germany, Germany's economic jugular. The Ruhr crisis, the Ruhr occupation of 1923, is the climax of this great dispute between France and Germany over the Versailles system, ultimately over whose power would dominate in Europe. Right? The Versailles system is a set of constraints on German power. The Germans throw off what they called the shackles of Versailles. German power would overwhelm that of France, especially since there was no counterweight to Germany in the East anymore. Right? Germany would be in a relatively stronger position than she had been in 1914. And it says, how could the French just accept that? You know, what would the point of the war have been if the French were willing to go along with that? So the French are not willing to go the whole route and just, you know, junk Versailles and allow Germany to reemerge as the dominant power in Europe, especially since France is not getting any assurances from Britain and America. The Americans withdraw, not just because the Senate refuses to ratify the League of Nations. American policy, it's hard to see how American policy would have been any different if the League of Nations had been ratified, because if America had been a member of the League, she would have pursued the same policy she pursued not being a member of. Same point about Britain. Britain was a member of the League. Didn't make any difference. Okay? What does this mean with regard to the theoretical issue that we've been concerned with? This issue of, you know, what makes for war? You're struck by the degree to which that whole liberal framework does not capture what was actually going on. It's very hard to make hard and fast moral judgments. It's very hard to say, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. Because you can see how the world looked through French eyes. You could sympathize with why the French pursued the policy that they did. A policy which was by no means aimed at crushing Germany. The French wanted to reach an accommodation with the Germans precisely because they felt that they were so weak in the long run.